Our second case of the morning is Conte against Holder. Mr. Didwania.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Vikash Didwania, on behalf of the petitioner, Alassane Conte. Given the limited time this morning, I'd like to focus on three of the Board's errors. First, the Board's misinterpretation of the materiality provision in the changed circumstances exception. Second, the Board's failure to properly apply the legal principle of judicial admission, despite Mr. Conte's admission to the date of entry in the amended NTA. And lastly, the Board's improper requirement of corroborating evidence, despite Mr. Conte's detailed and credible testimony. Starting with the materiality provision, after Mr. Conte filed his amended application in 2006, there was a military coup in Mauritania where a group of generals overthrew a democratically elected government and instead installed a military dictatorship. This change should have allowed Mr. Conte's amended application to be considered, even if it was allegedly untimely. But the IJ concluded that change circumstance exception is only available to applications that are filed after the change. The Board on appeal focused instead on the materiality requirement, and in this appeal, the government doesn't attempt to defend the IJ's decision. But the Board, in focusing on the materiality provision, erroneously required Mr. Conte to show a change in the basis of his fear rather than a change in the country conditions that worsened the situation for minorities in Mauritania. So, for example, the Board said that Mr. Conte's, quote, continued fear of the government composed of the same Arab people, and Mr. Conte will, as he was in 1984, be viewed as opposing the government should he not return to Mauritania, was its attempt to focus on his fear, continued fear of the Arab government. The Board conducted no analysis of any of the changes that occurred in Mauritania, such as the country reports that detail the deterioration of the human rights situation in Mauritania, the arrests and the mistreatment of detainees, the attempts by the government to create political divisions between the refugee community, all these changes. The Board considered none of that. It pointed to none of it. It didn't analyze how any of those changes could or could not affect Mr. Conte's eligibility for asylum, instead simply requiring him to show a change in his fear. And this was error, a legal error, a misconstruction of the materiality provision. Our position is supported, for example, by Singh v. Holder, where the Ninth Circuit explicitly rejected this position by the government that an applicant needs to show a change in his fear rather than simply an enhancement of his eligibility of his fear. The second thing I'd like to focus on is the judicial admission issue. So at the initial hearing with his lawyer, Mr. Conte first admitted allegations 1, 2, and 4 in the notice to appear. The third one originally alleged that Mr. Conte was admitted on an unknown date of entry. So Mr. Conte's attorney didn't admit allegation 3. At that point, the immigration judge amended the notice to appear and placed correct date, February 26, 2004, as his date of entry. And at that point, Mr. Conte then admitted allegation 3. Based on this court's precedent, at that point, the date of entry was an uncontroverted fact because it was alleged in the notice to appear and Mr. Conte had admitted it. And it was removed from controversy, therefore the date was no longer in dispute. And given that all parties agreed that Mr. Conte had filed his asylum application in November of 2004, which is less than 1 year after his date of entry, his application was timely as a matter of law, given this judicial admission.
What rule of law are you referring to here?
Well, Your Honor, for example, in Salimi and in Qureshi, the two cases that we cite, this court concluded that because an applicant or an alien had admitted allegations in the notice to appear, he could no longer contest them. They had been established and they had been removed from controversy, the facts that were admitted.
I'm still trying to figure out what rule of law you're referring to here. I mean, courts often say particular things about particular cases. If there were a regulation the board had issued, or if there were a precedential decision of the board saying, we're going to adopt judicial estoppel as a rule for the board, or we'll treat admissions in pleadings as conclusive, non-controvertible, then you could say the board violated that rule of law when it didn't adhere to it here. But that's why I'm asking, has the board ever done that? Has the board adopted this as a rule? Or the normal understanding is that rules of evidence don't apply in administrative proceedings, that the agencies can have their own rules. And so I'm trying to figure out what rules did the board establish for this question, for this general problem.
Yes, Your Honor, there's a regulation. I don't have it on me at this point, but the regulation states that once an alien admits to an allegation and notice to appear.
You're not dealing here with an admission by an alien, right? Your claim is that the agency, in some pleading, took a position which is then binding forever on the agency. Now, presumably, if it's going to be binding forever on the agency, there has to be some rule making statements in pleadings non-controvertible thereafter. Is there such a rule?
I think the rule that removes an issue from controversy once an alien admits that it is...
You're not relying on something an alien did. You're relying on something the agency did. And I'm asking, is there such a rule? You know, it's perfectly normal in a criminal prosecution, say, for the indictment to allege A, B, and C, and the prosecutor then goes and gets a superseding indictment alleging something else. And we don't say the allegations of the first indictment are conclusive. They can never be controverted later on. Maybe the board has made such allegations by Homeland Security conclusive. Maybe it hasn't. I'm just trying to figure this out.
I think what allows an issue to be removed from controversy and bind both parties is that the allegations and notice to appear must be binding on the agency, and then once an alien admits that, it's also binding on the alien. That's got to be the reason.
You say the allegations of the notice must be binding. What makes them binding? What prevents the agency from saying, we've now done further research, we've gathered more information, and we now think the fact is X? What prevents it?
Our position isn't that the agency is unable to amend the notice to appear. And once it amends it, of course, the superseded notice to appear can no longer be binding. It can provide evidence. But a superseded pleading isn't binding on a party. But it seems to me that the fact that an issue is removed from controversy must be, and binding on both parties must be, because the agency's statements in a notice to appear are binding upon it. Otherwise, it seems to me that an alien's admission to those allegations couldn't remove the issue from controversy. And there's a regulation, I think it's 8 CFR 1003.2 maybe, that states that. And here, of course, in the initial hearing, the immigration judge explained to both parties that after Mr. Conte had admitted the allegation, that he'd proven the date of entry, and the burden now shifted to the government to try and oppose that. And I think the only reasonable explanation for that is because the issue was then removed from controversy. And here, of course, once Mr. Conte had admitted this third allegation, he then, in light of that, also conceded that he was ineligible for voluntary departure, which requires that a notice to appear be provided more than 1 year after entry. And here, it was no longer controverted that his notice to appear in his asylum application had been provided less than 1 year after his entry. And his attorney maintained that position throughout the proceedings. And the third error I would like to briefly discuss this morning is the board's requirement that Mr. Conte have provided corroborating evidence. The IJ found Mr. Conte credible, but erroneously applied the Real ID Act, which even the government now concedes does not apply because Mr. Conte's original application for asylum was filed in 2004. But the IJ concluded that because the Real ID Act applied, he could require Mr. Conte to provide corroborating evidence despite his credible testimony. And the BIA upheld that requirement when it stated that it concluded that even if the Real ID Act didn't apply, Mr. Conte had to provide corroborating evidence because of his one use in his original application of the term rape rather than sexual abuse. And as we explained, this court has held that the agency must be aware, must be cognizant of translation errors from arising from word matters of degrees that may not be totally aware to the translator. And that was precisely Mr. Conte's explanation here, that his friend had filed the application on his behalf and at one point had used the term rape when he should have simply used the term sexual abuse or sexual humiliation. So it seems, and there's really no doubt that Mr. Conte provided very detailed, credible testimony about the harm he suffered.
You haven't mentioned what seems to me the board's principal reason, which is that your client used fraudulent travel documents, and the board inferred, as we had said in Al Saglati, it was perfectly entitled to infer that this indicates that the alien is entirely willing to lie whenever that will serve his own interests. Your client concedes that the travel documents were fraudulent, right? So we've got on this record your client's concession that he will indeed lie when that will serve his interests.
A couple points. One, this court has noted on several occasions, including in Dong v. Holder, that an applicant's use of fraudulent documents for entry have no bearing on his credibility or persecution.
Al Saglati expressly rejected that proposition.
But, Your Honor, Al Saglati didn't consider eligibility for asylum. It considered an agency's discretion to award asylum given eligibility. And this court said, well, in applying its discretion, the agency may consider the use of fraudulent documents because it may not want to award asylum to someone who's been who's lied to the agency. And we don't dispute, Asgadi's holding that in terms of discretionary award of asylum, the agency may consider it. But this is a different case about eligibility. And I think Dong more closely controls that use of fraudulent entry documents has no bearing for past persecution purposes. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there are no additional questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honor's counsel. My name is Margaret Cuny Taylor, and I represent the government in this matter. I'd like to address the two main issues that were raised with Petitioner's Counsel. First of all, the one-year asylum bar, and second of all, the withholding of removal denial. As to the one-year deadline for filing asylum, it's at all times the burden of the alien to show that he has filed within 1 year, and in this case, there is a problem with this court looking at it at all, because under INA 208A3. This court doesn't have jurisdiction to consider agency determinations made pursuant to the 1 year deadline. So this court shouldn't.
Well, under the Real ID Act, we have jurisdiction to consider issues of law, right? So the one asserted issue of law is that the Board of Immigration Appeals violated the rule of judicial estoppel. So I was trying with counsel to pin down where that rule is or how it's articulated. If there is such a rule, presumably we can insist that the agency adhere to it.
That's correct. Under INA
240. So let me ask the question to you. Is there a regulation or a precedential decision of the board establishing a rule of judicial estoppel?
There is no such rule, and there is no such board decision. The petitioner's argument rests on a Ninth Circuit decision, Hakopian versus Mukasey, which is cited in the briefs. And, of course, it's a Ninth Circuit decision, so it's not controlling in this court. In any event, even if the court looked at Hakopian for guidance, it would not help petitioners, the petitioner, because it's clearly distinguishable from what we have here, because in Hakopian, the government had set the date of entry in the notice to appear, and then the alien had agreed to it. And so once there was agreement, the Ninth Circuit found that there had been a what they called a judicial admission. Furthermore, there is a subsequent decision in the Ninth Circuit, again, not controlling, but pertinent to Hakopian, which is Cortes Pineda, in which the Ninth Circuit commented on Hakopian, and it said, Hakopian did not establish a blanket rule that facts alleged in an NTA, if admitted before the IJ, bind the court and the parties. And then it went on to say that it's certainly not binding where whatever has been admitted is subsequently contested. And in the transcript, there are a number of places where it's clear that everyone in the room, Mr. Conte's lawyer included, talked about how the date of entry was contested. I can point the court to some of these if that would be useful. Mr. Conte's lawyer, for example, at AR 160, said he entered the United States on a date that cannot be set. He then said on 161 and 206 that there was no finding as to the date of entry, and then he said at 207 the lawyer and Mr. Conte had been having difficulty getting corroborating evidence regarding the date of entry. So it's clear from the record that nobody thought there was an established date of entry. So under Cortes Pineda's comment about Hakopian, Hakopian just doesn't carry the day.
Can you get to the question of this Real ID Act? And you concede that the IJ wrongly relied on the Real ID Act to require corroborating evidence and that the BIA has required cases like that to be remanded. Why don't we need to remand this case for the IJ to apply the correct standards, especially since there was no explicit credibility determination with respect to Conte? And we know we have the issue of the fraudulent travel document. So why shouldn't this case be remanded so we can get a specific record, because it's not there?
Well, Your Honor, absolutely, the immigration judge's decision is flawed. I mean, the immigration judge should have been analyzing under pre-Real ID, and he analyzed under post-Real ID. But this is a flaw that the board caught. And so under board precedent, the Real ID simply codified, put into the statute, what the board jurisprudence already was. So the board deemed the immigration judge's credibility analysis sufficient because Real ID really didn't make a difference. Now the problem, as you've pointed out, is that this court, while it didn't outrightly reject the board's position on what this court calls the corroboration rule, did institute a three-point test. And just an aside, the petitioner's opening brief also addresses post-Real ID analysis, rather than pre-Real ID analysis. So this has been a source of confusion by, you know, throughout, even before this court. The government's position on the three-point test and the explicit credibility finding is that while the words adverse credibility finding are not in the decision, there is lexicon in the decision, which I'm happy to point out, which shows that that is really what the immigration judge and the board were doing or thinking about. For example, the immigration judge on AR 100 said, the government attorney contends that the respondent's story is not credible. So the immigration judge was thinking about credibility. And then on 102, the immigration judge pointed to exaggerations and misstatements and the false passport, which Judge Easterbrook talked about. And on page 104 is the even assuming sentence with a reference to credibility. So, of course, it would have been preferable if either the immigration judge or the board or both of them had said the words adverse credibility. But the question really is whether that topic was addressed and whether it's worth sending it back just to put in those words, or if that would be sort of a formalistic exercise and nothing more than that. I'd also like to point the court to a couple of decisions, the Seventh Circuit decisions, where the court did find under pre-Real ID that that there was no explicit credibility finding and sent the cases back. Yes. One definitely yes, and one I think it is. The first one I'd like to point to is Ikama Obambi. It's at 47F3rd 720, and this is in the briefs. It's a government loss where there was no explicit credibility finding, but it's different from this case. Because in Ikama Obambi, there was no noted discrepancy. The immigration judge had just made some references about his doubt, but he didn't really point to a discrepancy, whereas here we have a noted discrepancy. The other one that I'd like to point to, and I'm going to give you the citation. I can certainly 28J it because I'm not 100% sure it's in the brief.
It's not in your brief. Under circuit rules, you're not allowed to discuss it at oral argument. No
surprise.
All right.
Well, then I won't discuss it. Then I won't discuss it. So, Judge, does that answer your question?
It does.
All right. Thank you. Your Honors, if there's nothing further, I'd like to ask that you uphold the board's decision, that you dismiss in terms of the challenge to the one-year deadline determination, and that you uphold the denial of withholding or removal. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Mr. Dinwanian?
Yes, Your Honor, a few points. First, I'd like to clarify, when you'd asked, Your Honor, about a board rule concerning judicial stop or judicial admission, and I'd refer to 1240.2. It's actually HCFR 1240.10C, which says that if the respondent admits the factual allegations and admits his or her removability under the charges, and the immigration judge is satisfied that new issues of law or fact remain, the immigration judge may determine that removability of charge has been established by the admissions of the respondent.
But he didn't do that here, did he? Didn't he find that the applicant failed to produce evidence of when he entered?
So there was an original IJ, and then the IJ was replaced by a different one. And the original IJ stated, after Mr. Conte had admitted the allegation in the notice to appear about the date of entry, that this date of entry was established, and the burden shifted to the government at that point. I think when the IJ then shifted to a different one, there was some confusion. But we, our position is that IJ erred by not upholding the binding nature of these concessions, this judicial admission that binded the parties. And the other point I would respond to is counsel's statement is about the IJ's credibility finding and the idea that we all know what the IJ or the board were thinking. That's precisely why this court has required consistently for the IJ to make an explicit credibility determination, so it doesn't have to go into the mind of the IJ. And here there's no text in the IJ's decision making an explicit adverse credibility determination. The IJ at several points notes that under the Real ID Act, an otherwise credible applicant may be required to present corroborating evidence. And then the IJ goes on to say, this applicant is otherwise credible, but I'll still require corroborating evidence. And all of that comes from this court's decisions noting that, often in pre-Real ID Act cases, evidence cannot be required of an otherwise credible applicant. And I could find no case pre-Real ID where an applicant was determined credible, and this court upheld a requirement of corroborating evidence. And going back to the judicial admission issue,
counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.